roll out the red and white carpet. It's Canada Day.
You didn't know we had a Canada Day?
I knew.
We have a capital, too, a nation's capital.
So, and I've been to Ottawa.
That's a good start.
CBC host Gian Gomeshi is back as we present, that is, politely suggest, our redesign of the Canada brand. Plus, a remarkable new film combines family drama and apocalyptic fantasy in the Louisiana bayous.
The whole universe depends on everything fitting together just right.
The storm's coming! The storm's coming!
Y'all better learn how to survive.
I'll talk with the director of Beasts of the Southern Wild. That and lots more is ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. The biggest news this week came out of the U.S. Supreme Court, including on immigration. Muddle is too charitable a word for U.S. immigration policy, that is, how we should deal with the millions of foreigners living illegally in this country. And the court didn't add much clarity when it ruled that most, but not all, of Arizona's new immigration law was unconstitutional. And that decision came on the heels of the president's announcement that his administration wouldn't deport any of the 800,000 young unauthorized immigrants who arrived here as children. Julio Salgado is one of those 800,000. He's an artist and video producer who's part of a new movement among the undocumented to out themselves. He was one of dozens pictured on a recent cover of Time magazine. And this week, he's got art openings in both Berkeley and New York City. Julio Salgado, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having me.
So let's get your basic story first. How did you come to be living in the United States?
I came to this country when I was 11 years old, and my sister became really ill, and so she needed a kidney transplant. And so the doctors said, you have to stay here, and she needs a kidney transplant, and you know, any parent who's dealing with that kind of situation, they're not really going to think about anything else but saving their child alive. And so there was really no way to fix our status other than to go back to our country. And that meant that my sister could potentially die, you know, if we were to go back. There was definitely a discussion of we're going to have to stay here, our passports are going to expire, but, you know, we really don't have any other choice. The other choice, you know, we didn't even want to think about the other choice, you know.
So after sort of 17 years of this twilight existence, you've declared your status in this very public way. Why do that?
I was in the ninth grade, and I found out that I was undocumented, and I couldn't get, like, a real job. And I wasn't really, like, my friends. I had this, like, little secret. And I cannot tell you how, you know, the what it feels like to constantly be living with this fear of, like, I could get deported and not see my family for a long time. I could, you know, it's this fear that I don't know how to explain it. It's a fear that we all have of having to leave a place where we've, you know, sort of built home, built communities. And so when in 2010, a lot of students started coming out publicly. And very much, very parallel with the coming out of the queer community, what it's like, you know, coming out in numbers and feeling like you come out and it feels like this big weight comes off your shoulders because, you know, you've had the secret for so many years.
Did the experience personally of coming out as gay at first sort of, do you think, led you to think, oh, I can do this too?
I think so. I mean, and it's no surprise why there are, you know, the majority of people who are leading, you know, the movement, who are organizing a lot of the sittings, a lot of this marches, are in fact queer.
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's. I know many of the folks who are organizing, in the communities, and they're queer. They're queer or they're women. I don't find that surprising at all, because as a queer individual, I know what it's like to be sort of like in the shadows and like have the secret. And when I came out, it was alleviating. It was great.
In addition to your artwork that plays with advertising sort of iconography about undocumented people, you do this YouTube series of vignettes that is revealing and funny called Undocumented and Awkward. I want to play a clip from your episode 2, in which you play a hotel cleaner who happens to run across an old high school friend who's staying at the hotel.
Yes.
You're trying to make a little bit more money, and that's why you're working here?
Well, it's just, you know, I might, you know, like, I haven't fixed my immigration status, and so, like, I, you know, they don't really ask, you know. They don't really pay a lot, but they don't ask for a lot, so.
But you have a degree.
Yeah, I have a college degree.
And you work here.
Yeah, I know, right? Yeah.
Okay.
So that's you, Julio Salgado, as a hotel room cleaner in the little video dramedy called Undocumented and Awkward. How, for instance, autobiographical is that?
It's probably 98.2 biographical. I say 98.2 because I used to work in the food industry, and I never actually worked as a hotel worker, but like the rest of the story is pretty much parallel to my life. You know, when I was in college, I met the other three co-founders of this website. You know, we graduated from college, and you know, here we had like our degrees, and we couldn't get a job using our degrees. So we were like, you know, we still want to do something creative, and we developed this website, and we started developing this series to sort of, you know, make fun of our situation. You know, all of us who are behind this were like huge fans of like SNL skits, and so there was a lot of inspiration from that. And, you know, we don't think we're funny, but people like them. And they started passing them on, which is, you know, which is great. And we just want to open it to everybody who wants to do the same.
Julio Salgado, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on your show.
You can see some of Julio Salgado's artwork and watch his Undocumented and Awkward video at our website, studio360.org. The new movie Beasts of the Southern Wild is sort of a Louisiana fairy tale with a 6-year-old girl as its hero. Her name is Hush Puppy, and she lives with her father in this isolated bayou netherworld that they call the bathtub.
One day, the storm's gonna blow, the ground's gonna sink, and the water's gonna rise up so high, there ain't gonna be no bathtub, just a whole bunch of water.
The storm does come, and not just the storm, but somehow Hush Puppy survives and refuses to leave her home. Beasts of the Southern Wild has won all kinds of awards at film festivals the last 6 months, and it's the work of a first-time 29-year-old feature film director, Ben Zeitlin.
I always think of it not as a fantasy movie, but a film with kind of a heightened reality. That sort of happens through the subjectivity of the main character. You know, the fact that you see everything and experience everything the way that a 6-year-old would, you know, at that age, you really don't parse out the difference between what's imaginary and what's actually happening. It's all very real, you know, even though adults are telling you some things are real and they aren't, you know, as a kid, you don't have that experience.
And that kid in your movie is played by Quvenzhané Wallace. She is, as you know, just exceptional, and not just a cute kid who reads her lines well. She has this amazing range, and she's physically impressive as she sort of climbs over and under debris, wearing the very white rubber boots I wore when I was her age. The success of this film really depends on her. How did you find her? How did you direct her?
We found her through kind of brute force. We spent 9 months looking for kids. We looked at somewhere between 3,500 and 4,000 people for the role.
Down there?
All down in South Louisiana. No one in the film had ever acted before. It was all cast locally. You know, but it wasn't like a close race. She came in and just had this, you know, you put the camera on her and you just see gears turning behind her eyes, and you see this focus and kind of morality, and just you know, you see that, and you just see your character emerge, and just you it all becomes clear when we found her.
So really, it was like an aha moment. We've got her. Stop the presses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
How she's never acted before in her life. How do you direct a kid? And you've never made a feature film. What was the process of making her do what you needed her to do?
I mean, it wasn't that tricky. It was she really has an amazing ability to internalize information, and, you know, I would explain to her, you want to get your father's attention in the scene, do everything you can to get his attention. If he tells you to go away, don't listen to him. And she is amazing, because while you're telling her this, she'll be like eating gummy bears and pulling someone's hair, and then you say, were you paying attention? He said, yeah, you know, you want me to follow my father, blah blah blah, like, and I'll say these three lines. And she's just incredibly smart. And we initially thought that we were going to do things like have someone jump out from behind a wall and surprise her to try to get her to look surprised. But her focus is so intense that stuff didn't work. You know, you would have someone jump out from behind the wall and she wouldn't flinch. She just would stay in character. And so we realized very quickly that we just had to work with her like an adult.
She sounds almost as extraordinary as the character.
She truly is. She truly is.
This is a story, among other things, about holdouts, people who refuse to leave their homes even when the houses have been destroyed and the sort of twisted nature is killing them. Is that a kind of character that you're drawn to in general?
Yeah, I mean, it was that was really where the film started, and it came a lot from, you know, the short film that I made in 2006, and that cast was all local, and it was all people that were there very soon after the storm. And, you know, there was a lot of rhetoric in the country at that time of this sort of, why rebuild? Like, New Orleans just should go away. This is irresponsible to live there and all this stuff. And I thought it was such a ridiculous – it was such a ridiculous conversation being there and sort of knowing – these people and how much their home meant to them and how much their culture meant to them, and just the idea that it could be transplanted is just crazy. And I definitely wanted to make a film that celebrated the people that hold on and that are fighting to keep this place alive.
Does that have any analog in your life? I mean, your life on its surface seems very different than theirs.
Well, I think I come by it honestly. Like, my dad tried to get down to Coney Island and handcuff himself to the Thunderbolt before they knocked it over. So, you know, this sort of notion of, my parents are both folklorists, and this notion that a place is worth preserving and a culture is worth preserving, even if it isn't designed by some famous architect, even if it doesn't have some sort of high art
or industrial importance.
It's like there's importance to the cultures of the world, and to see them disappear is the worst kind of death. And so I think that probably that was instilled in me in some visceral way by the folks.
You're from suburban New York. After Katrina, a lot of people from elsewhere came there suddenly with ideas about how to tell the story of the people there and the land and the water and all that. Did you encounter any resistance as a carpetbagger?
No, not really. I mean, you know, first of all, we weren't in New Orleans. You know, we were in a totally different place, which is not accustomed to people from the outside coming down as much. It's all the way down an hour and a half
south. Sean Penn wasn't there in boats ahead of you?
No. This is like, you know, this, not a place that gets a whole lot of publicity. It's an hour and a half south of New Orleans, all the way at the end of the road. And among the great things about the culture is it's people are like virtuosos in making fun of someone. And so when you come down as a kid from suburban New York, you are absolute gold for ribbing and jives. And so I would hang out in the docks and just became like everybody's favorite joke. And then, you know, as you hang out longer, you tell people you're making a movie, and it's such a – the culture has such a warmth and hospitality to it that even though there's maybe a kind of wariness and a sort of territoriality when you first set foot, you know, you're around for a week and you're over for dinner and you're getting taken alligator hunting, and, you know, it really – I think I was a bit of a novelty, and that probably worked in my favor.
And so you put up with the hazing, and after a while they say, okay, fine.
Yeah, you know, they knew you're going to be around, and so – it's like a new friend.
You also composed the music in the film with Dan Romer. I want to play one of the themes, which is from the beginning of the film, before the storm, when the people in the bathtub town are having a celebration. And if you would, just if you can sort of deconstruct it as we listen and explain what we're hearing and what was the goal of the music.
Okay.
Here.
Okay, yes. If we wanted to create both a feeling of like this celebration, but also let you know that something ominous is overhead, that this beautiful place is not going to stay utopian forever. What you're hearing right now is sort of Cajun song taken from the region where the film was shot by the Balfour Brothers, and we wanted to sort of mix in Cajun songs with our orchestration and kind of create something that was a blend of the two.
But me and my daddy, we stay right here. We's who the earth is for.
And then this is really the bathtub theme, and we wanted to create something that felt anthemic and like a national anthem or like Auld Lang Syne, this sort of iconic folk anthem that everyone in the town would know how to sing. Later in the film, when the place falls apart, you can sort of remember it by that song, the way that, you know, you would remember your country if it was gone by a tune that came from it.
Anthemic, which is a word thrown around a lot, is exactly right for that song. And it's one of those things that make it not like a little indie movie.
Yeah, I mean, she doesn't see... We tried to score it from her point of view, and she certainly doesn't see herself as a little indie character. She's like a folk hero, or she's like a tiny little warrior, and so...
And she knows she's important for history.
Exactly. It reminds... The theory behind it is sort of when you're six, you know, sometimes you're just walking down the street doing nothing, but you have the Batman theme playing in your head, you know, and so... That idea that you need to know how she feels about her own story, and that's where the adventure of the film emerges from.
Ben Zeitlin, congratulations, and thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ben Zeitlin is the director of Beasts of the Southern Wild. It starts opening in theaters this weekend. You can see a clip from the film at studio360.org. Coming up, it is time to reveal the results of our latest redesign project. Canada, as reimagined by some world-class designers. And we'll announce the winner of our listener contest to craft a new slogan for Canada. That's all coming up in a minute in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Keep me searching for a heart of gold.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. While our fellow Americans gear up for the 4th of July next week, Studio 360 is going a little rogue. We are celebrating Canada Day, July 1st. For our neighbor's 145th birthday, we decided to give the Canada brand a makeover. We asked you for suggestions, and we hired an international design firm, Bruce Mao Design, to help us. Leading up the team at Bruce Mao Design are Hunter Tura, President and CEO, and Sarah Felsky, Associate Creative Director. Hunter, Sarah, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks for having us.
Hi.
I am truly excited to see what you have, and I see a giant title card on your computer screen that says Bruce Mao Design redesigns Canada. So show me what you got.
Okay.
I just want to say, listeners right now can follow along with this presentation that Hunter is doing online at studio360.org.
So for us, we saw the challenge as the Canadian brand has become cliche. And here you see some of the cliches, you know, the maple leaf, the hockey fight, the husky with the RCMP officer. What we're trying to do is replace those with 21st century Canadian icons.
You've got your Arcade Fire. You've got your Ryan Gosling.
That's right.
Seth Rogen, Douglas Copeland, Margaret Atwood, Drake.
Part of the research is that also that not a lot of people know that these people are Canadian. So we wanted to like push that to the forefront.
Because they can pass so easily as Americans.
Right.
And also, you know, we have things like the oil sands. Canada is a resource-rich country. I think the 21st century in many ways will be the Canadian century by virtue of its vast resources. In a way, the American century was the 20th century for similar kinds of reasons. But there's a but here. In our research process, we reached out to notable Canadians, asked them their view on these questions. This is a quote from Scott Thompson. Many Americans will remember from Kids in the Hall. "We know you, but you don't know us." And that actually was the starting point for us in our work. Canada didn't need to be rebranded or redesigned. America needed to be educated. And that is the basis for our campaign. No Canada.
So this is No Canada, K-N-O-W Canada, and it's a command rather than some deferential, "we're nice Canadians."
That's right. It's an imperative, and you'll see from a design perspective the kind of strategic omission of the maple leaf using the two red bars of the Canadian flag as a framing device to showcase all of this dynamism, you know, was the basis of, you know, how we saw this identity system.
And you've got vertical red bars on all of these posters and bus signs and everything else, and those are motifs from essentially the Canadian flag without the maple leaf.
That's
yeah,
right.
Yeah, and there's a lot that we love about Canada and the Canadian heritage. So we kept the red bars as like a nod to the past as well, and knowing that we want to introduce what Canada is now, but also embrace where it came from.
And as we began to explore how this identity system could roll out, we got really excited about some of the possibilities. So what you see here is the two red bars as a spatial urban object, which might frame certain landmarks in Canada
like
for tourism.
Essentially 12-foot red sculptures.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Those are cool.
We imagined that even the passport stamp that you get when you visit Canada could incorporate this identity, which you see here on the right.
And again, the big bold red bars are really dominating every version of this.
Obviously, when you visit Canada at the airport, you're going to take home a No Canada T-shirt and beer mug, and we've brought you a No Canada T-shirt for your collection.
And the T-shirt is cool because the red bars are on each side such that they appear to have a slimming effect as well.
Yes, we're always image conscious.
We did that on purpose.
It's terrific. It's great. And I thank you. It seems like this could be adopted by the government of Canada tomorrow. I mean, this is sort of, as we say in this country, shovel ready.
That's right. And we've secured a URL, nocanada.org. You know, we hope we can continue to host that with you. But we do want to show this work to Canadian politicians and see if we can actually advance, you know, some of these initial ideas that we've had.
Excellent. Hunter, Sarah, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Kurt.
That's Hunter Tura and Sarah Felsky of Bruce Mao Design. And you can see the new improved 21st Century Canada designs they came up with at studio360.org. When we launched our Rebranding Canada project, the very first thing we did was ask you, our listeners, for some help. Write a new slogan for Canada in 6 words or less. 750 entries later, we have a winner. And that winner lives in Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada. Hi, is that Dave Fuller?
Yes, it is.
Hi, it's Kurt Anderson from Studio 360.
Hi, Kurt.
So, you know, you're a finalist in our Canada slogan contest. Do you remember your entry?
Yes. I think in 6 words it was, "Canada, we're not just colder, we're cooler."
Which is terrific. And in fact, we have decided the most terrific. You've won our contest.
You've got to be joking. That's great.
I am not joking. How did you, it's really good. And I wondered how you came up with it.
Two things. Canada is known, for better or for worse, as being cold, which is not always the case. And we're usually sort of patted on the head for being nice or polite or
yes.
not too noticeable, which is also a little annoying after a while.
Yeah.
A bit like being told you're a good kid, and you're like, oh, you know what? I don't want to be a kid anymore.
Totally. And given that in the last decade or so, especially, Americans have become so familiar with and in love with Canadian bands, for instance, the cooler
yes.
has resonance in that sense that it might not have, you know, 20 years ago.
I know, and man, are we happy to hear that.
One thing, I mean, in this collaborative spirit, maybe it would be stronger if we said, not just colder, cooler, taking out the weir. Would you have any problems with that?
Not at all. I'm all about editing. I work for a newspaper.
Perfect. Perfect. And of course, in addition to the glory of winning the slogan contest, you also win a trip to Washington, D.C.
Are you kidding?
I'm not.
That's phenomenal.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, congratulations, Dave.
Thank you very much, Curtis. It's great to talk to you.
And happy Canada Day.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.
Now it's time to bring back Gian Gomeshi, the host of Q, the CBC's daily culture show. Happy Canada Day, Gian.
Happy Canada Day to you, too. We'll make it an international holiday.
We could do that. And, well, it effectively is, since 3 days later, of course, it's Independence Day.
We're kind of the opening act. We're like the support act.
Precisely. So it is now time to do what we have really gathered here today to do, which is to test each of our knowledge of the other's nation and culture. And we've got somebody here who is the perfect person to do that. Ophira Eisenberg, who is a comedian and a writer and the host of the new NPR quiz show, Ask Me Another. Ophira, welcome.
Why, thank you.
She is our quiz mistress.
I'm the quiz mistress.
Fantastic. Can I just issue a disclaimer
of
here,
course.
Ophira, from the top? I know a lot about the United States. I've been all over the United States. So if these questions of yours, quote unquote, stump me, I won't accept this.
I like your
quiz,
confidence. It's very un-Canadian.
How American of you.
Yeah, it's good. It's good. Not one apology in that entire sentence. Well, we'll see how you do, John.
Sorry.
And by the way, I just want to make clear, and why, as soon as I found out that Ophira grew up in Calgary, that I didn't insist that she disqualify herself, is that she, of course, left Canada to live here in the United States.
But you could only accept a quiz with somebody, with the quiz mistress being in America.
No,
you couldn't handle it.
I could definitely handle it wherever. I want to make sure that, right. that you know, she is effectively Swiss.
I was the only person that answered the ad.
All right. I'm ready. Bring it on, America. Bring it on, Yankee boy.
I think we're going to start with you. All right.
Go ahead.
Immigration reform is obviously a big topic in America, especially in the current presidential race. But where do immigrants in the United States come from? As you might expect, many come from Mexico, China, and India. But can you name three of the other top 10 countries of origin of U.S. immigrants?
I'm going to say Japan, and I'm going to say England or the U.K. And I don't know why. And I'm going to say Germany.
Wow, those are excellent guesses.
All three of them
incorrect.
Are
incorrect. Oh, all three. Canada. What about Canada?
Oh, I didn't know Canada was included.
Canada's
yeah,
one?
Yeah, I should have said Canada. You're right. Yeah.
You don't... Oh, interesting. Philippines, Vietnam, Cuba, El Salvador, the Dominican Republic, and Korea.
That's a trick
See,
question.
See, you learned something already.
A trick question?
I think you picked the three countries that have the highest Canadian immigrants.
Yeah, I did, actually. And I didn't even think of Canada. I mean, I'm a disaster already.
So, Kurt...
Yes.
Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
This is an audio question. Identify the Prime Minister speaking here during the 1970 October crisis.
Well, there's a lot of bleeding hearts around who just don't like to see people with helmets and guns. All I can say is go on and bleed.
At any cost? How far would you go with that? How far would you extend that?
Well, just watch me.
That would be Mr. Pierre Elliott Trudeau.
Correct. This, by the way, is your right bing.
Good. Well done, Kurt. Well done.
Thank you,
sir. Well done for knowing our longest-serving prime minister.
I couldn't name.
It was almost impossible to not. It was impossible.
See, if he knows Diefenbaker,
yeah, yeah. We're in trouble.
All right, Canada exports a lot of things to the United States. We have oil, major export wood, and female singer-songwriters. Who was the first female Canadian singer to hit number one on the American music charts?
Beneath its snowy mantle, cold and clean, the unborn grass lies waiting for its coat to turn to green.
The snowbird sings. Dusty Springfield?
Dusty Springfield. That is incorrect.
Who is it?
Are you joking?
This reminded me of my childhood. Yeah, he doesn't know.
Not a
Canadian.
That
is Anne Murray.
Anne Murray, who was featured in the South Park song.
I recognize the song.
I'm sorry.
It's okay. You don't have the Anne Murray's greatest hits like the rest of us, I guess.
I was listening to Joni Mitchell at the time. What can I say?
Nice save. All right. He's only one ahead.
Yeah, this is good. This is like the shootout. And it's, I'm coming back here. I feel it. I can't believe you didn't get that. But then again...
Now you're feeling confident.
No, I'm not, but I'm feeling a bit better. Let's go geography, man. I'm ready.
Geography, yeah, I feel good about this one. Right. Everyone knows the tourist destination, the Four Corners Monument, right?
What are the four states? You're going to ask me, right?
Well, sort of. I'm going to give you one and ask you, if you were started in Utah and walked clockwise around the monument, what states do you pass through in order until you get back to Utah?
Colorado.
Yes.
Sorry, I'm going clockwise, right?
Yep.
Colorado. No. Arizona. Utah. No.
That's correct. Correct.
I didn't finally give it to you. Colorado, New Mexico,
just,
Arizona,
I'm just giving
Utah.
It to you.
All right.
Yes.
Is that right?
Colorado, New Mexico, Arizona,
that's
and
not
Utah.
Bad.
You did it
impressive.
Perfectly. You have done some traveling.
Impressive. I was trying to draw it.
And just know now, you're tied. All right, we're back to you, Kurt.
Okay.
You may be surprised to know that there is a Canadian Oxford Dictionary that is filled with words only true Canucks need to know. And in 2004, the phrase double-double was added to the COD. What is a double-double?
I'll take the hint on this.
Okay. You can order a large, medium, or small double-double at a Tim Hortons donut shop. Word is giving this away.
It's
right?
Like some chocolatey, luscious drink, coffee-ish thing.
You've never been to a Tim Hortons?
No.
Wow.
I've heard of it. I know about it.
You've heard of it. It is how you order a coffee in Canada if you want double cream and double sugar. It's the double-double.
Right.
It's like the light and sweet here.
Right. Gotcha.
It's pretty good. You got there. You got close.
All right. Potpourri or culture?
I'm going to go potpourri.
What American founding father advised this? Love your neighbor, yet don't pull down your hedge.
Founding father. So the founding fathers were the guys they had like there at the beginning, right? So it's either like Jefferson or Washington or James Madison or something.
Would you like a hint? You still have a hint ready?
Yeah, give me a hint.
Puff Daddy wrote a song about him. Would you like to hear it?
Puff Daddy wrote a song about him. Yeah, play it.
Talk about giving it away.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So it's Franklin.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Hint.
Well, I can't. Yeah, I think it's a hint. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
All right. So right now.
Talk about filing complaints with the authorities.
2-1, Canada. All right.
Canada, you're in the lead. All right, this is your last question, Kurt. It's Canadian geography.
Okay.
And this is a question close to my heart because it's about my home province of Alberta. Mm-hmm. In Alberta, which of the following is not a real place? Medicine Hat, Drumheller, Bummer's Roost, or Head Smashed in Buffalo Jump?
It's one of those First Nations names, isn't it? My belief is that the Head Smashed In one is an attempt to make me think that's too ridiculous. That's the funny D answer. And yet, I can imagine that being a First Nations name. And Bummer's Roost, I don't believe it because I think Bummer
is indeed a Hell's Angels phrase that was coined in the 1960s. So I'm going to go with the head smashed in one. Is as real as am I supposed to do the fake one, right?
Which one's not real?
Oh, Bummer's Roost.
Well done.
That is correct.
Brilliant.
Bummer's Roost
Brilliant
is
deduction.
A real place. It's a ghost town in Ontario, but it is not in Alberta.
So it was a trick question that I was too stupid even to understand the trickiness of the question.
You really got into the mind of the quiz writer. You got right in there and you got it correct. It paid off. Bummer's Roost. It's hard to imagine why that place didn't take off. All right, well, John.
So now give him one of our easy questions.
And this is a audio question for you. Released in December of 1973, this was the first horror movie ever to be nominated for Best Picture.
Of course, there is one outside chance for a cure. But I think of it as a shock treatment.
Okay. I think this film came out later, so I'm not, but I'm going to take a shot at it because it's the biggest, so I'm going to say The Exorcist.
You are correct.
Okay.
The Exorcist.
And the shocking thing is that it was nominated for a Best Picture.
I know. That movie really turned heads.
Okay. So basically he's going to win because Hollywood, being American, is really a global industry, and who wouldn't have known that? But okay.
I love seeing everyone's personality come alive with a trivia quiz. Isn't it amazing?
That was amazing. That was really impressive, Kurt. It's too bad that you still lost.
Lost by one.
Yeah.
Well, but how about our final lightning round, Ophira?
Oh, yeah.
Well done.
It's nicely done.
I take no pleasure. I was pathetic.
Canadian, come on, just say thank you.
And I thought Kurt was very impressive, although... Really not knowing Anne Murray is a little bit problematic for me.
So, Ophira, thank you so much for coming in and doing this important binational translator, interpreter, honest broker job.
Investigation into what glues us together.
Exactly.
It was my pleasure.
Ophira, thank you for rigging it so the Canadian could win. I appreciate it.
Anytime. I'm glad you got the questions last night.
And, Jean, it has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Been a great pleasure, Kurt. Thank you.
And what it all comes down to. Is it ever?
Coming up, one way people these days know Canada is from its pop music.
You know, it's really, really big, but there's very few people there. That definitely influences, you know, what you're making and how you're living.
One of the newest singer-songwriters to break out from up north calls himself Bahamas. He's live in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Our Redesign Canada project started with the simple truth that Americans don't really know or care that much about our northern neighbors. But that doesn't apply when it comes to Canadian musicians. Neil Young, Joni Mitchell, Robbie Robertson, Leonard Cohen, Katie Lang, Arcade Fire, they've all made it big here while still having a special Canadian thing going on.
Time and time again, my love, I wonder where you are. Time and time again, my love, I found you among the stars.
Afi Yervainen played guitar in the band of another Canadian gone big time, Leslie Feist. But for the last 3 years, he's had his own band called Bahamas.
His new album is called Bar Chords, songs with a bit of twang, not unlike some of Afi's Canadian predecessors. Afi Yurvanen and Bahamas, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks very much.
And happy Canada Day.
Right back at you.
One thing I think people respond to when they think of Canadian singer-songwriters is a sense of longing in some of the music, like those Shadows of Geese falling on our eyes in Neil Young's Helpless, or Joni Mitchell drawing a map of Canada on a napkin in a bar. Is that for real? Does that sense of longing for somewhere or something far away work as a theme in your music or life?
Yeah, I think in Canada, it's a giant country. You know, it's really, really big, but there's very few people there. It's like half the population of California. So that definitely influences, you know, what you're making and how you're living.
So you're not a snowbird yet, but you've named this band Bahamas. How come?
Well, I suppose it plays into that idea of you know, romanticizing some place that I have no idea what it's actually like. I mean, it's probably just full of you know, tourists and made in China.
It's actually not.
Like
it's
that.
Nice. You've not been to the Bahamas?
No, I've never been there. No.
Wow. We should when you go, let us know.
Sure. Yeah. I could probably apply for like a Canadian grant to go there and go on vacation or something and get a tan.
Canada has a lot of grants, doesn't it?
We're really lucky. The arts are heavily subsidized there.
Let's hear some of this music of longing and Canadian reinvention that we've been talking about. What are you going to play?
We'll play a tune called Lost in the Light. Lost in the light, I pray for the night to take me, to take you too. After so many words, still nothing's heard. Don't know what we should do. And if someone could see me now, let them see you. My greatest thrill when we just stood still. You let me hold your hand till I had my fill. But even counting sheep don't help me sleep. I just toss and turn right there beside you. So if someone could see me now, let them see you. Let them see you through all those hard things we've all gotta do. 'Cause this life is long, so you wouldn't be wrong. Being free, leaving me on my said some awful things, I take them all back. If we would try again and just remember when, before we were lovers, I swear we were friends. So if someone could see me now, let them see you. Let them see you. All those hard things we've all gotta do. 'Cause this life is long, so you wouldn't be wrong.
being free, leaving me on my own.
That is wonderful and perfect. Thank you. That's Afi Yurvanen, also known as Bahamas, performing Lost in the Light off his new album, Bar Chords. Afi, can you introduce these two people with these incredible angelic voices standing next to you?
Right here next to me is Carly Akins. She's from Barrie, Ontario. And next to her is Felicity Williams from Toronto.
And they are yours, or not that you own them like chattel.
I would never say that.
This is your band.
I would never have the courage to say that. But yeah, I do. I'm really, really grateful to get to sing with them, and just, you know, for my voice to be part of many. You know, because I do think that, you know, people singing together is some sort of elemental thing. It's like banging a drum, and you know, I really respond to it, and I feel that other people do too, and. Yeah, I don't know.
So you knew him when he was a kid growing up in Barrie. Has Afi become a big, has he changed now that he's a big star?
He's only grown and matured and soared.
She's also contractually obligated to say that.
Good. I'm glad you got her on that. There's a video of you put out for this album of the place where you recorded this song and the whole album at, I guess, a friend's place in the country, and it's them between lounge chairs and the drummer by the fireplace and big pile of firewood and a pie in the kitchen. Did that affect how the music came out?
Well, yeah, it's just this wonderful, magical place sort of tucked into Northern Ontario. And it's a part of Ontario that's really not developed. I mean, it's protected wetlands and things like that around there. So it's just a beautiful part of the world. And I just personally really benefit from, you know, being focused like that. And we don't spend a whole lot of time recording. You know, we did the whole record in about 6 days.
So you don't do lots of vast post-production on these records?
I don't really do pre-production or post-production I think of it in, you know, there's two ways of doing things. You can put in a lot of effort at the beginning and try and write really good songs, and then it makes the recording process relatively easy. But if you go in, you know, and I have done that before, if you go in unprepared and you don't really have your songs finished or worked out completely, then to me, that sort of seems when you're, you know, you're pulling your hair out, sort of wondering, what are we supposed to be doing right now?
Well, may we hear another of those songs from your Ontario country hideaway?
Yeah, absolutely. It's called Already Yours.
Is it really that much sweeter on the other end of that receiver? There's no need to convert a believer. I'm already yours. I'm already yours. Well, I ain't that special someone. You should spend your life with the fun ones. Someone who makes to become one. I'm already yours. I'm already yours. Always said, don't mind me, but your love always seems to find me. It's always creeping up behind me. I was never yours.
That was Already Yours by Afi Yervanen, Bahamas. And I got to say, I was already yours listening to the record, but man, that's really good.
Thank you. Well, thanks very much.
Afi Yervanen records as Bahamas. His new album is Bar Chords, and you can see a video of his performance here, as well as listen to some of his music at studio360.org.
I go there too. I go there with you. The darkness, it paints me in.
So I'd been friends with Nora Ephron, who died this week, for the last 20 years or so. And I totally adored her. Every time I was in her presence, I felt like I'd lucked out, as if right this second I'm realizing my wildest childhood dreams of life in New York City. She was so smart and funny and wise, as you know from her movies and books, but she was also a good egg, a mensch. Some years back, she joined me here to talk about The Wizard of Oz, one of her favorite books.
I must have read Ozma of Oz 50 times, and I remember as a kid spending hours trying to figure out what age did I want to go to Oz at? Because when you went to Oz, you stayed the same age forever. Even though I know The Wizard of Oz is a great movie, it's still not what was in my head. Because you can't ever create something concrete that has so many imaginative possibilities. You're making it finite when you turn it into something concrete, it seems to me.
Today, I feel an awful hole in my life and in our cultural life. I will really miss Nora Ephron.
And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
That's it for this week's show. Thanks very much for listening.
Yes, I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, computers are getting smarter and smarter, but will they ever think like us?
No machine is ever going to experience the rest of the world in the same way that a human being does.
Can computers be creative? We'll try to find out next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.